or before his strange moods, his anger, his lies. When he pulled away, I was aware of a rapid popping noise behind us. Jim looked stunned. How weird. He stood, moving to the guitars mounted on the wall. He widened his eyes, mystified. All the strings just broke. Every single one. He grinned. It must be your effect on me. I smiled weakly. My decision to tell Jim everything set off some gangster movie escape scene from the funeral, wavered, and stalled the moment he took my hand and we rejoined his family. There were so many uncles, cousins, women wearing black mink coats and stilettos with toothpick heels, swirls of blonde hair like sugar garnishes on $34 desserts. We made our way outside, a glamorous black-clad procession up Madison Avenue into the Frank E. Campbell Funeral Chapel. Last time I was here, it was for Allegra DeFonso, a woman told me. The funeral service was long, filled with sniffling people quoting Dylan Thomas and Bob Dylan, Let It Be by the Beatles. There was a speech from a red-eyed woman who couldn't stop clearing her throat. Children snickered over an ancient man in the front row announcing too loudly, It smells like cat piss, before a nurse escorted him out. Jim smiled down at me and squeezed my hand. I found myself staring in wonder at a photo of the dead man. Great-Uncle Carl, memorialized in a laminated poster propped on a brass easel beside the casket. He had mottled red skin and an oblivious yellow smile. Had he ended up in some kind of neverworld? I was closer to Great-Uncle Carl's state than any of these people could imagine. I had to tell Jim. However, once the service ended and the crowd spilled onto the sidewalk, black Cadillac Escalades lined up 8 deep, everyone shaking hands and muttering condolences and observations about Carl, how he did it his way and was a son of a gun. Every time I was about to tell him, I need to talk to you. Some new person tapped his shoulder and gave him a bear hug, asking how he'd been, when his first musical was premiering on Broadway. Jim was amiable and kept trying to make his way back to me, but before he could, someone else would approach. When he finally rejoined me, he had 2 girls in tow. He knew them from grade school. Beatrice, meet Delphine and Luciana. I'd always recalled the girls as intimidating and otherworldly. Seeing them now, they weren't as jaw-dropping as I'd remembered, though they had waist-length hair which they tossed out of their eyes like ponies, and a bored manner that could be mistaken for expertise. Jim kept putting his arm around me as he talked, but after a while, as I stood listening to stories about Millicent, Castman, and Ripper, whether these were people, a law firm, or impossible to get into nightclubs, I couldn't tell, I began to feel like a giant old L-shaped couch that had been carried out to the sidewalk and left there. The feeling continued when we piled into an Escalade. We were a large group. Jim was forced to sit in the back next to Luciana. I sat next to an elderly woman wearing red taffeta who reeked of alcohol.
"Here we go again to do what we do," she mumbled.
We were dropped off at Jim's great-aunt's apartment on Park Avenue. Jim deposited me on a love seat by a porcelain pug and disappeared on a mission to find me a Coke. After 45 minutes with no sign of him, I stood up and roamed the dense crowd, perusing bookshelves and photographs, slipping down crowded hallways as if I knew where I was going. I peered into the kitchen, where caterers were sweating over ovens and trays, and a guest bathroom where the wallpaper looked like 24-karat gold. It was all coming back to me, how desolate I'd felt, adrift in a place I didn't belong. I'd wanted nothing more than to be away from these people, back in Watch Hill, eating lasagna with my parents, hearing my dad talk about a new BBC David Attenborough program on Netflix. Now, 5 years later, inside the Neverworld, I wasn't nearly so sensitive, but I was still bothered by Jim's absence. Where had he gone? He told me he'd gotten stuck talking to relatives, and I'd believed him. The question gnawed at me. I snooped in room after room, searching for him in bedrooms that resembled hotel rooms, offices that looked like libraries, an echoing marble gallery filled with aviation antiques behind glass. Jim was nowhere. Neither, worryingly, were the two girls. At one point, when I opened a closet filled with nothing but Japanese puzzles and board games, Jim's father, Edgar, stepping out of an office, spotting me, and doubtlessly noticing how awkward I looked, beckoned me. "Jessica," he said to me, smiling warmly, slipping what appeared to be a small black flash drive attached to a rubber bracelet over his wrist. I caught a glimpse of a series of digital numbers flashing along the side before he pulled his shirt sleeve over it.
"Can I get you a drink, my dear?"
"No, thank you, Mr. Mason."
"Edgar, come meet my partner, Craig, and his daughter, Greta. Greta just returned from Sri Lanka, where she was a visiting neurosurgeon at the district hospital in Colombo."
Obviously, high-powered Craig and his neurosurgeon daughter didn't want to be saddled talking to a mute high school freshman, so it was a matter of seconds before they turned to greet someone.
"Bertrand, is that you?"
And I slipped away. I couldn't call Jim. I didn't have a purse with me, much less a phone. I could wait where he'd left me. Eventually he'd come back, wouldn't he? Another hour went by. With each passing second, my plan to confess, run away with him, began to grow stale and sag. When I was jostled for the third time by a woman toting a giant alligator handbag, and Mrs. Mason slipped past me with a cardboard smile, Martha's words of warning suddenly leapt into my head. "We don't know how we're going to react. The past hooks you like a drug. The future jolts you like an electric chair. Reliving beautiful memories can be just as devastating as reliving the terrible ones. They're addictive." Maybe it was shock at being forgotten by Jim again. The nagging question of his lies about Vita Joshua, or the understanding that one of my friends had tried to destroy me, deliberately sticking me with the pin to send me back to some other moment in time, doubtlessly believing I'd be too smitten with Jim to ever leave his side again, trapping me here forever. I leapt to my feet, barging through the crowd. In the hallway, I snatched my burgundy coat off the coat rack. It abruptly collapsed, sending piles of minks to the floor. I threw down my old coat, seized the fattest, most unwieldy fur I could find, and shrugged it on, hit by a wave of perfume. I ran down the hall, my heart pounding, pressing the down button for the elevator. It splintered under my finger. I wheeled around, shoved open the door to the stairs, and raced down each flight, light bulbs in the lamps overhead shattering as I passed each landing. I charged out into the lobby, the doorman gawking. How could I have forgotten where I was and what I had to do? Didn't I want to live? I sprinted outside. The wind was strong, too strong, the green awning chattering and flapping in the gale. I ran to the sidewalk, about to hail a cab, when I heard a girl's shrill laughter. Wheeling around, I saw Jim. He was perched on the wrought iron railing in front of the building next door, Delphine and Luciana beside him. They were talking to a doorman, cracking up over his comical impression of someone, what looked like Marlon Brando in The Godfather. They were all howling so hard they couldn't stop. I stood there, frozen, willing Jim to look up and see me. But he didn't. Staring at his grinning face, I realized then. I saw it as plain as day. I hadn't even crossed his mind. Maybe I never did. I wanted to shout his name. I wanted to scream like some vengeful witch in a fairy tale, causing clouds to fast forward across the sky, wiping the smiles off their faces. "Jim Mason, in 4 years you'll be dead!" He leaned back so carelessly, hooking his arm around Luciana's neck and nuzzling her ear. My heart felt freshly sliced in two. I'd been so stupid, so blind. Tears sprang to my eyes. I veered around and ran out into the street, nearly getting hit by a taxi before the driver slammed on the brakes, honking. I climbed in.
"Honey, are you okay? What the... Jesus!"
The driver blinked, mystified at the sight in front of him. The green awning to Jim's apartment building had come entirely free in the wind, detaching from the sidewalk. It was barreling down Fifth Avenue, clanging and swooping. It collided with the rear windshield of a town car before soaring straight up into the air, gold poles flying out, bystanders shouting as it was flung through the sky like some strange, soaring monster. I'm anything but okay. Martha had said to meet back at Wincroft in the event of an emergency. Always go back to the original wake. If we have that as our meeting place, there remains a hope we can all eventually convene there across space and time. To change the wake again, go back to the coastal road if you can and do the exact same thing, okay? If you can't get to the coastal road, find a suicide. I took the train back to Newport. When I arrived, it was after 10. I climbed into a waiting cab at the station, asking the driver to take me to Narragansett. It was a half-hour drive, and I didn't have money, but I figured I'd be able to think of something at Wincroft. The gate was open. The lamps were lit. As the cab accelerated down the drive, I could see the driver sit up and glance at me curiously in the rearview mirror, wondering if I was an heiress. The house lights were on. There were 8 gleaming cars in the driveway. As the cab waited, I went running up the steps and rang the bell. When the door opened, I found myself face to face with ESS Bert. He wasn't as creepy as I remembered. In fact, he looked like any rich man in a pastel sweater. There were voices coming from the dining room, glasses clinking. Apparently, I had interrupted a dinner party.
"Can I help you?" he asked.
"I'm looking for Whitley."
"She's not here. She's up at her boarding school, Darrow Harker."
"We were supposed to grab dinner tonight."
He was surprised. "Did you try calling her?"
"She's not picking up."
I went on to explain that unfortunately I didn't have enough money to pay the $48 for the cab. Blinking in bewilderment, Bert pulled out his wallet, jogged down the steps, and paid the driver.
"I guess I'll go back to my hotel and try Whitley later," I said.
He nodded, puzzled. "What did you say your name was?"
"Beatrice."
Bert didn't know what to make of me, a gawky girl in a black mink bulky as a killer whale. I waved to him and took off on foot down the driveway. He watched me, then disappeared back inside, apparently too preoccupied with his party to wonder, if the cab had driven off, how I was going to get anywhere. I circled back to his vintage car garage, typed in the 4-digit security code. Thankfully, it was the same code as 5 years later, and the door rose with a groan. I hurried to the key stand in the back and unhooked the keys to the rolls. Driving out to the coastal road, I expected sirens. None came. My heart began to pound. I could feel the wake coming on. Checking the time, I realized in surprise that this wake had shortened. It had been barely 8 hours. I could feel the crushing heaviness pressing into my legs. I floored the gas, engine roaring. The prospect that I might end up with Jim again, back in Central Park, if I didn't make it into another wake, willed me to drive faster and faster. My legs went numb. As I rounded the curves, the car seemed to fly out from under me, tree branches scratching at the windshield like an angry mob. When I reached the hairpin curve, I veered into the bushes, narrowly missing a tree. I barreled out, lurching into the middle of the road, the strong wind shoving me down across the yellow line. I rolled onto my back, gasping. The sky was a deep night blue, freckled with stars. I had no idea whether this plan would work. Would the open window even be here anymore? I slowed my thoughts and closed my eyes. August 29, Villa Anna Sophia, Amorgos Island, Greece. I waited for a car to come, but there was only the deafening wind in my ears, the shrill hiss of crickets, the distant whoosh of the sea, even as a metronome. I heard a piercing whistling, growing louder. A bicycle. It came at me suddenly, the rider swerving to avoid me, losing control, crashing into bushes on the side of the road with a clang of metal, shouting. The biker was uninjured. After a moment of gasping and swearing, he lurched to his feet. He stared down at me, faceless in the dark. "What the fuck?" he whispered as his head jerked up in surprise, headlights of an oncoming car illuminating him like a flash camera. He threw himself out of the way as my world went dark.
Chapter 20. When I opened my eyes, I was lying on my stomach on wooden planks. Instantly, streaks of vivid blue tore into my vision. It was the ocean. I raised my head, blinking. I was wearing cut-off jean shorts and a faded pink Captain's Crow t-shirt. I was lying on a dock, barefoot. I turned my head and saw the white wooden staircase zigzagging up the sheer rock face at least 100 feet high. Villa Anna Sophia. I'd actually made it. Lightheaded with relief, I lurched to my feet, only I was so woozy I stumbled and was sick, nearly falling into the water. Catching my breath, I lurched to my feet. I headed up the stairs. With every step I took, pebbles and rocks loosened under the planks, bouncing, plummeting down the cliff into the ocean. I kept moving. I didn't look down. When I reached the top, panting, the house, a wild architectural marvel of glass and steel, sat before me, totally silent. It looked deserted. I hurried past the pool, an inflated swan raft drifting leisurely in the center, and tried one of the glass doors. It was locked, the windows shaded. I was just wondering if I'd gotten the wrong day when I heard a woman scream. With a pang of unease, I tore down the stone path, past the olive trees, to the front, where I saw Kipling outside the massive double oak doors. He appeared to be keeping watch. I was so relieved to see him, I threw my arms around his neck. "Thank goodness," I whispered.
"What? My... How did you manage it, child? Martha said we'd lost you, maybe forever."
I pulled away. There was no point going into what had happened, not yet. Blinking up at Kipling, though it hurt me to think it, I reasoned he could very well have been the one to stick me with the pin. Yet he seemed genuinely relieved to see me.
"I made a mistake," I said. "Where is everyone?"
"Inside." He made a face. "We've tied the whole family up and we're trying to extract information, but it's not going well."
He shrugged, visibly nervous.
"We tried the nice way, arriving casually, announcing we happened to be on vacation, and were friends of Jim's, and we wanted to know about his death, and so on. But they're slippery eels, the Masons. They served us grilled octopus and basil sorbet and invited us for a dip in their pool. Before we knew it, 4 hours had passed. We were all drunk on ouzo, and we hadn't had one real conversation about Jim. Whitley got fed up. So these last few weeks, she's gone nuts on these people. The deluxe Whitley special, you know, with the screaming and the punching of walls and the throwing dishes."
He sighed.
"Edgar Mason has his 24-hour security detail, but they switch shifts at noon and they're lazy, so that's when we strike. We've got 2 tied-up guards at the end of the driveway."
I frowned.
"But how many wakes have you had?"
5. Each one lasts about 5 hours. How many have you had?"
1.
This had to be what Martha meant about instability, trains speeding in different directions at different speeds, the risk of never being in the same place at the same time to vote. There wasn't time to worry about it, not yet. Kipling had opened the door and was beckoning me inside. There on the couches sat Mr. and Mrs. Mason, tied up, along with their 4 children, their eyes red from crying. They were watching Whitley in mute horror. She looked like a South American gorilla, bandana wrapped around her head, t-shirt knotted in a crop top around her waist, a mad glint in her eyes. She was holding a gun on Mr. Mason. The side of his face was swollen. It was a shock seeing Jim's family like this, when at the last wake they were crisp as fresh flower arrangements, floating around, air kissing people at Great Uncle Carl's funeral. Spotting me, Whitley widened her eyes in surprise. She raced over.
Beatrice, she said, hushed. Where the hell did you come from?
I gave her an abbreviated version of what had happened, how I'd accidentally returned to a different date but managed to get back to the coastal road to change the wake.
So you're all right then?
I nodded. Where's Martha? Trying to log on to Edgar's computer, not having much luck. What about Cannon?
He's gone.
I stared at her.
What?
She shook her head with a bleak look. He never arrived. We have no idea where he is. One second he was there and the next, nowhere. I recalled the person I'd seen sprinting into the woods.
Cannon.
Hello? Oh my God, is that you?
Mrs. Mason, sitting on the couch, craned her neck to get a better look at me. I'd never seen her so forlorn. She was almost unrecognizable. Her face was red. Her blonde hair, usually so immaculate, had wilted like a plant left too close to a radiator.
Who are you talking about?
Asked Mr. Mason.
That little girl Jim went with in school. You know,
her.
She glared at me.
You're involved in this? You let us go right now. We have no information about Jimmy.
I grabbed the gun from Whitley and pointed it at Mrs. Mason. She gasped.
Tell me what you know about Jim's death, I said.
She glanced at her husband, terrified, then back at me. She began to whimper. It was an odd sound, like a beach ball losing air through a tiny hole.
Leave her alone, bellowed Edgar suddenly. Gloria has nothing to do with this, you little con artist.
I pointed the gun at him.
What happened to Jim?
I've told you people countless times now, he said, spitting. We know nothing.
That's impossible.
He shook his head.
The police told us it was suicide.
Jim never would have done that, and you know it.
I don't know it.
Mr. Mason appeared to be crying, staring at the floor. That was when I remembered. I stepped behind him, inspecting his wrists, which were bound with zip ties. I yanked up the cuff of his shirt sleeve. Mr. Mason knew what I was after, because he immediately began to contort himself, trying to move his hands away.
No, don't you dare!
It was the black rubber bracelet I'd seen him wearing. He still had it on 5 years later, though this one seemed an even more sophisticated version, with digital letters and punctuation with the numbers. I couldn't pull it off his wrist, so I went into the kitchen, returning with a knife.
Don't you dare! Don't you dare!
I sliced the bracelet off his wrist.
Now you've done it. Good for you. Bravo. Kiss your future goodbye, Missy, because you'll be spending the rest of your life in a hole so foul you'll beg to be sent to prison.
I should be so lucky, I said. I turned to Whitley, who was blinking at me in shock.
What got into you? She whispered.
I'll be in Mr. Mason's office, I said, racing up the spiral staircase. Martha was stunned to see me.
Oh my God, what happened?
It's a long story, but I'm fine. I raced into the all-glass tower, pulling a chair alongside Martha behind the hulking desk. She couldn't seem to stop staring. Naturally, it made me wonder if she had been the one to stab me with the bumblebee pin. But there was no figuring it out. Not yet. I've been trying to log on to Edgar's laptop, she said, indicating the screen. It's impossible. There are 3 prompts for encrypted passwords. I stared down at the shifting line of numbers, symbols, and letters on the bracelet. They reset every 15 seconds. I typed the displayed sequence into the 3 password boxes. The computer unlocked.
Are you kidding me?
Whispered Martha in awe.
Like that? How did you...
I'll explain later. Before I clicked into the desktop, I placed a piece of tape over the webcam. I didn't know what would happen when it became clear that there was a security breach, but I knew we'd have to work quickly. Edgar Mason had a personalized email interface called Torchlight Command. As soon as I opened the program, a timer recording my activity appeared in the upper right corner of the screen. The first thing to do was to search for emails from Jim. We couldn't find one. Searching for the names of his brothers and sisters turned up countless emails, but there was not a single message either to or from Jim.
"He's been wiped from his father's email," whispered Martha.
"Why?" "Maybe he wrote something inflammatory."
She shrugged.
On the hard drive, there were over 2,000 folders on a cloud server called Torchlight Library. I searched for Jim Mason. Nothing came up. We found a trove of financial records, listings of obscure holding companies with names like Redshore Capital America and Groundview Fund, with addresses in the Cayman Islands and Panama City. There were trade receipts and wire transactions from a bank in Turkey to another in Switzerland, some of which listed dollar amounts so enormous they looked like typos. If any of it was illegal or tied in any way to Jim's death, the truth was buried under layers of names, numbers, and symbols, none of which could be easily excavated.
"Maybe Edgar's committing fraud," said Martha.
"Sweatshops? Child exploitation? Maybe Jim found out about it and they had a major falling out." "If Jim had found out something like that, he'd have been devastated, yes. But he wouldn't have killed himself."
She shrugged.
"What if Edgar hired someone to kill Jim?"
I stared at her, surprised. "His own son?"
"If he thought he was going to lose the empire he built, why not?" Suddenly she sat up, frowning, pointing at the glass walls. I realized in horror that every pane was breaking. All around us, thin cracks were spidering through the glass, branching out one after the other.
"The instability of the Neverworld," whispered Martha.
I nodded and hurriedly clicked back into the inbox. I certainly didn't want her to wonder what the destruction meant, if it was all being caused by me. I leaned forward, squinting at the screen. "Most of Edgar's emails are from this woman named Janet," I said, clearing my throat. "His executive assistant. They have a system where she reads his emails and summarizes them." "Chris Endelberg, president of Princeton, called," Martha read slowly. "He appreciates the way you handled the matter, re-S-O. They'll hold off on disciplinary measures."
"Huh. Okay, what else?"
We scanned the emails in the weeks leading up to Jim's death. There was nothing unusual. A board member was problematic. Patrick has to go. A real estate broker wanted to show Edgar an off-market listing for an estate in Bedford worth $48 million. "Sick pad, man." Someone involved in a fast food restaurant wanted another loan. "I hear your concerns, but it's time to expand on the line of frozen fried chicken dinners with romance-related flavor names." In the days following Jim's death, there were emails about funeral arrangements and flower deliveries, the West Side Boys Choir, lists of who was attending and who would speak. It was oddly cold to read through. Just like that, Jim's death was another action item in his father's inbox. My name was buried among 300 others.
"I don't get it,"
whispered Martha, frowning at an email she'd just opened.
"What?"
"S.O. wants to change his dormitory, FYI. She glanced at me. "This is from Janet. He needs you to call the Princeton dean and make it happen, as this isn't freshman policy.
Bizarre."
"What's bizarre?" I asked. "Another email from Princeton. Who in the Mason family goes to Princeton?" It was a good question. Jim was the oldest. His other siblings were in grade school.
"Who is S.O.?" I wondered.
We did a search of the initials. One more email appeared. As I opened it, the wall of broken glass in front of us spontaneously fell away, millions of shards sliding across the roof and down the side of the house. A powerful gust of wind billowed through the room, sending the gauzy curtains flying out and stacks of papers swirling off Mr. Mason's desk.
"We don't have much time," I said hastily. "The system is about to lock us out."
Martha nodded, biting her lip, and peered closer at the email. S.O. wants lunch tomorrow to discuss a business opportunity. Booked 1 p.m., Jean-Georges.
"Try searching the keyword Princeton," Martha said.
I did, and one more email appeared. "Chris Endelberg of Princeton wants to thank you personally for your donation. Invited you to dinner, 2:24. I declined, as you'll be in Buenos Aires."
"S.O. could be a cousin," I suggested. "Maybe Edgar pays for his education?"
"Or S.O. is his emotional support animal, wearing a yellow vest which he takes with him on planes, trains, and automobiles."
This appeared to be her attempt at humor, though you could never tell with Martha.
"Or S.O. is his imaginary childhood friend," I said.
"Or S.O. is his sixth personality, as he has secretly suffered from schizophrenia for years."
We smiled at each other, though unsurprisingly, the moment ended as soon as we realized what was happening. We weren't on edge in each other's company. That was when another three walls of glass dropped away and a strong gale barreled through again, papers exploding around the room. At that moment, Whitley stuck her head around the doorframe.
"The wake is 3 minutes away," she frowned. What's happening in here?"
Martha leapt to her feet.
"It's the Neverworld. We have to go, now."
They hurriedly explained their plan. We needed to head back to Wincroft to find Cannon. The Masons were impossible to break. It was better for the five of us to get back together than to keep interrogating them. Our questions were eliciting no new information about Jim.
"Use the cliff for the wake,"
Martha ordered cryptically before ducking out. I remained where I was, searching Edgar's laptop as the wind howled around me and papers cycloned, every glass wall falling away. Not a minute later, the desktop speaker sounded an alarm, and I was locked out, the screen going black. I leapt to my feet, and as I hurried past the open spaces overlooking the backyard, I spotted Martha, Kipling, and Whitley running out of the house and past the pool toward the cliff.
"Use the cliff for the wake."
I watched, stunned, as they stood side by side at the very edge. They joined hands. Then they jumped. When I returned downstairs, the Masons looked terrified. They'd seen what I'd just seen. They believed now that we were all crazy. I questioned them for another hour. Mr. Mason's cell rang incessantly. So did the landline. A printer wailed in a room upstairs. It was doubtlessly torchlight security trying to alert Mr. Mason of the security breach. Holding the gun on him, I said I wanted to know what he and Jim had argued about in his final days alive.
"What are you talking about?" he wailed. "My son and I didn't argue. We never argued." "Who is S.O.?"
"S.O.?"
he looked confused.
"The freshman at Princeton."
He sneered.
"It's a colleague's son. What does he have to do with—" "You truly are a troubled young woman, my dear. If you have any sense, you'll untie us all, go back to your dingbat life, and hope—no, pray my fleet of attorneys doesn't decide to spread you on a cracker and serve you as an hors d'oeuvre."
I tried setting a few more verbal traps for Mr. Mason to fall into, telling him Jim had confessed to me all about his financial fraud. I tried to see whether he looked uneasy or afraid. Unsurprisingly, my blind fishing elicited little more than confounded stares and indignant comments from the family that they'd always thought I was a good girl, which made my involvement in this nightmare all the more disappointing.
"There's no need to pretend," I said. "You never liked me. And my name, in case you were wondering, is not Jessica or Antonella or Barbara or Blair. It's Beatrice Hartley."
I shot the gun into the ceiling. Instantly, minute cracks fanned out through the plaster, spreading into every corner, then moving down the walls.
"We'll give you any amount of money,"
whimpered Mrs. Mason, worriedly eyeing the ceiling. That was when I felt the wake coming on. I set down the gun and left without a word, leaving the Masons staring after me, uncertain, afraid. As I raced past the pool, I saw two police cars inching up the vertiginous drive. One emerged, shouting at me in Greek. I ran to the edge of the cliff. As I stood there, the rocks and dirt began to loosen and tumble under me, as if I were the weight of a building, as if I weighed 10 million tons. Boulders were pulling out of the ground. I leapt into the air, shouting just as the ground dropped out. I was plummeting fast, upside down, breath sucking from my lungs. Blue sky spun overhead. I squeezed my eyes shut, trying to quiet my mind as I thought of Wincroft the day I'd first arrived there, though almost immediately something else slipped into my head. A connection. It was barely remembered, an itch at the back of my brain. I'd seen it before. Twice. I tried to ignore it. Spiky grass, bushes, and cypress trees were spinning past me. Screaming, I opened my eyes to catch sight of the entire cliff through the dust, then the house dismantling behind me, a roaring mass of shattered glass and steel and rock coming for me as we all fell toward the sea. It was too late. Chapter 21.
Hun? You okay?
Someone was shaking my shoulder. My eyes opened. I jerked my head up, shouting. A large woman with red hair and heavy eye makeup stared down at me, visibly freaked out. She was wearing a pink visor emblazoned with a cartoon chicken, a heart on its chest.
Sorry, hun, you can't sleep here. Do you need me to call someone?
I looked around. I was in a wooden booth in a cramped fast food restaurant. People around me were eating fried chicken and fries and drinking milkshakes. The walls were covered with heart wallpaper, photos of couples kissing or holding hands. I blinked at the paper mat and the tray in front of me. Alonzo's Honey Love Fried Chicken. One taste and your love struck.
Where am I?
I blurted.
Newport. I can call your mom for you, hun. Or a shelter?
I shook my head and lurched to my feet. I realized dazedly that I was wearing my old Darrow uniform. A white blouse, green tartan skirt, black tights, the beat-up black Steve Madden ankle boots that had seen me through 4 years of school.
Seriously, I can call someone.
I pressed a hand to my throbbing head and stumbled away from the woman. What had happened? Why hadn't I made it to Wincroft? Then I remembered the thought that had slipped into my mind as I'd been falling. It was what Vita had said, about the ride she'd given Jim. Some dingy section of town. Dollar stores. A pet store. The parking lot had some man in a chicken costume handing out heart balloons.
Why did Jim want to go there? Martha had asked her.
Maybe he wanted to eat fried chicken and buy a pet iguana? I have no clue. Fried chicken and hearts had turned up again in the coupon inside Jim's empty case file. $5 off a bin of Honey Love Fried Chicken, Soulmate Special. Finally, it had appeared in an email I'd read in Edgar Mason's inbox. A restaurant owner had been asking for another loan. I hear your concerns, but it's time to expand on the line of frozen fried chicken dinners with romance-related flavor names. I staggered past the cashier, blinking at the laminated advertisement on the counter. All new, Honey Love Fried Chicken Organic Chicken Dinners, now available in the frozen food aisle at a supermarket near you. Try our original flavor, Honey Love Mesquite.
May I take your order, miss?
The teenage boy behind the cash register was staring at me. With a fitful smile, I shoved open the door and moved outside, steadying myself on a Newport Daily News vending machine. After a moment, I realized I was staring at someone wearing a yellow cartoon chicken costume passing out heart-shaped balloons to passers-by. The strip mall was exactly as Vita had described it. There was a handful of people loitering around the parking lot. I leaned down to check the newspaper date. Friday, May 14, last year. I'd managed to get it right. After all, I remembered the night I'd watched Jim drive away with Vita as if it were yesterday. An elderly man was pushing a shopping cart loaded with shopping bags past me.
"Excuse me," I asked. "What time is it?"
He checked his watch.
12:49.
Vita had said she'd dropped Jim off around 8 or 9 o'clock, which meant I had nearly 8 hours to kill until he appeared. I hoped the wake would last that long. If Jim even did appear. It was a long shot. It also wasn't the worst connection to make. Whoever had confiscated the papers from Jim's case file at the Warwick police station hadn't looked twice at the coupon, but what if it had been actual evidence? What if it had been stuck in Jim's file because the detectives had been tracking his movements during the final days of his life, and they discovered he'd come here to this complex, to this restaurant? My head was still pounding. I slipped along the covered sidewalk, past a liquor store, a dollar mart, a pet store called Man's Best Friend. I had to change my clothes. If Jim did come here, the restaurant was small. He'd spot me immediately. But I had no money to buy clothes. I watched the people come and go, men in faded t-shirts racing into the liquor store, women hauling toddlers, an old woman bent over 90 degrees pushing a cart. When I spotted a smiling woman leaving a stationery store walking a Pomeranian, I approached her.
"Excuse me, ma'am. I'm hoping you might help me. I need a change of clothes."
She picked up her dog with a horrified look and climbed into her car. I ended up going into every store at the shopping center, striding brazenly through employees-only swinging doors into back storerooms, janitor's closets, and cargo unloading areas to see if I could find some kind of spare uniform. I managed to steal a pair of khakis from Man's Best Friend, a hoodie from a manager's closet inside the Stop and Shop. I asked an old man pulling a pint of Ben and Jerry's out of the freezer if I could have his baseball cap. There must have been something totally desperate or strange or otherworldly on my face, because he handed it to me without a word and quickly wheeled his cart away. I hurried into a Chinese restaurant, Fu Mao Noodle, and changed in the bathroom, grabbing a handful of fortune cookies by the register as I left. I sat eating them on a bench outside the pet store facing the parking lot, a feeling of dread in my chest. Small opportunities are the beginnings of great enterprises. You are the architect of your fortune. Big journeys begin with a single step. I had to change benches 3 times, because every one I sat on, the wood began to splinter and crack under me. One even collapsed in half. The longer I waited, the more afraid I was that I'd been right to track Jim here, that he'd actually appear. Was he meeting some other girl? What had preoccupied him, been so shameful that he couldn't tell me about it? What had he been so afraid of? At 8:05, a beat-up red Nissan pulled into the parking lot, a for sale sign in the back window. It slinked up to Honey Love Fried Chicken and the passenger door opened. Jim climbed out. Black t-shirt. Jeans. I could see Vita behind the wheel. Jim entered the restaurant. Vita waited a moment, as if to make sure he wasn't coming back. Then she drove off, exactly as she'd said. I waited another minute. Then I darted along the covered walkway, ignoring the fact that every column was spotted with black mold. I peered through the glass door. Jim was standing at the counter, his back to me. I quickly slipped inside and took a seat at an empty table by the window.
"Call him again,"
I heard Jim say. He sounded angry. The woman he was speaking with, the one who'd shaken me awake, was mystified.
"I just did. He said he'd be right out."
"Call him again."
Frightened, she grabbed the phone, dialing.
"He says he'll be right out."
Seconds later, a Hispanic man with a thick mustache appeared from a back room. He was slight, mid-40s, a kind face.
Jim, it's been too long. How are you?
We need to talk.
I'm about to jump on a conference call. Why don't you come back after closing?
We're going to talk now.
Disconcerted, the man beckoned Jim to follow him. I slid to my feet, watching them disappear through the back door. I waited another minute and headed after them, pausing to hear another door slam before I darted inside. The kitchen was in front of me. Beyond that, there appeared to be a back office. The door was closed, but it looked thin, and hurrying up to it, I could make out the voices easily enough.
I'll ask you one more time. Who is Estella Ornato?
What are you talking about?
Estella Ornato!
She... Well, yes, she's my daughter.
And?
And?
4 years old. She died last year. That jog your memory?
Jim, please, let's not do this here.
Do not pick up that phone or I swear.
Jim?
For once would someone tell me the truth?
Who told you? Where is this coming from?
Your brother wrote me a letter. Estella did not die in a car accident.
Jim, Jim, now hear me out.
The voices quieted. Abruptly, something large smashed against the door.
Tell me the truth or I swear to God.
Excuse me, said a woman. You're not authorized to be here.
I turned. It was the redhead. She was indignant, hands on her hips.
I have an interview with your manager, I blurted.
She squinted at me, puzzled.
A second deafening crash from inside the office was disturbing enough that she quickly forgot me and went hurrying back to the kitchen to confer, wide-eyed, with the teenager behind the cash register.
Did my father pay for this, and this, and this?
There was a high-pitched cry, followed by a moan. Alarmed, I pushed open the door, barging in to see Jim throwing a bag of golf clubs on Mr. Ornato, now cowering on the floor in a fetal position. Jim started kicking him in the stomach.
Jim,
I said. He turned, startled. The redhead barged past me into the office.
Oh my God, Mr. Ornato, are you okay? I'm going to call the police.
No, no, it's all right.
Gasping, he rolled upright, his face sweaty, his hair standing on end.
There's no need. It's just a misunderstanding. Let's get back to work.
Jim wiped his face in the crook of his arm, dimly surveying the demolished room. Then he began to sob. I stepped toward him and put my arms around him.
Let's get out of here,
I whispered into his ear. We sat on the curb outside Fu Mao Noodle. We watched the cars speed past in the closing day, the sky going blue and black, traffic lights changing from red to green to yellow. We watched small black birds land on telephone wires and fly away, heard the giggling wheels of shopping carts. All that ordinary life, vending machines belching up sodas, stock boys taking cigarette breaks, cars backing in, backing out. I watched it all as Jim told me everything. I listened in shock. It made perfect sense. His father's obsession with security, Jim's distraction and moodiness, his decision not to tell anyone, not even me. If he had told me the truth before, would it have changed everything? Would he still be alive? It had to do with the boating accident. Jim and a friend had taken out a speedboat on Mekox Bay, and they'd crashed into a fisherman in a skiff. When Jim woke up in the hospital, he heard the story from his family and the police, all corroborated by articles in the East Hampton Star. No one except Jim was hurt. The fisherman happened to be none other than Alonzo Ornato, the owner of Honeylove Fried Chicken. But this wasn't the whole truth. Alonzo had had his 4-year-old daughter, Estella, in the boat with him. She was killed on impact. This should have resulted in a charge of manslaughter against Jim, which meant, as a minor with his father's connections, at most,
Given that he'd been drinking, he'd have gone to a juvenile facility for a few months, maybe even weeks, and would have been released on probation. That wasn't good enough for the Masons. Instead, they decided the incident shouldn't have happened at all. So they decided to erase it from history and redesign the past. They struck a deal with Alonzo Ornato. They would take care of him and his family for the rest of their lives. Monthly allowances, new houses and cars, Ivy League educations for his other kids, bottomless loans for his business. All in exchange for erasing Estella from the boat that day. She would die in a car accident instead. Mr. and Mrs. Mason arranged the whole thing with the assistance of torchlight. They drove Alonzo's car into a tree, artfully inflicting the right kind of damage so the police wouldn't ask any questions. "Wipe the spill off the kitchen counter," said Jim. "Remove all signs of rot. Fumigate the foul odors seeping through the basement. All for me. So I'd suffer no shame, no heartache, no pain. I could continue my life guilt-free like a diet drink. I could soft-shoe toward my golden destiny." He stared blankly at the pavement. "They don't realize they've destroyed me." I touched his arm. "That's not true. You can still do something." "You are such a liar," whispered the voice in my head. "What can he do now? He's dead." "Like what, B? It's gotten inside my head. It's why I've been sick, why I can't write a goddamn decent note anymore. I'll never pick up another instrument, because their poison is inside me." He hit the side of his head scarily over and over. I grabbed his hand to make him stop. "They've killed me, don't you see? You should contact a newspaper. Turn them into the police." He laughed bitterly. "Sure, I'll turn them in. That'll solve everything. My family will be destroyed. My brothers and sisters will have convicts for parents. The whole world will loathe us. We'll become poster children for all that's depraved, all to placate my guilty conscience. What good would it do? That girl will still be dead. That's the worst part. I can't do a goddamn thing. I've gone over it and over it." He began to cry again, head in his hands. I stared out into the parking lot with a strange feeling of desolation and calm. Jim was right. Even if he were alive and this moment were real, what could he do? Start a foundation in Estella's name? Write a musical about it all? The awful thing was, what the Masons had done was like toxic gas pervading everything. We stared ahead in silence, holding hands. It felt as if we'd both removed our glasses, and now we saw for the first time that the world had never been as beautiful as we'd always thought. It was a vision lost, never to come back. "At least I have you, Beatrice," said Jim, squeezing my hand. "You save me." "But you don't have me. I'm not even alive. Neither are you. We're ghosts. We're air. We're approximations." I felt a painful lump in my throat. I wanted to cry for him, for myself. My legs were growing heavy. It was the wake. I didn't know how much time I had left. It seemed to be moving through me faster now. My head felt as if it were melting. Jim frowned, surveying me. Perhaps he was wondering how I'd known to follow him here. Then I realized he had noticed the black mildew covering the cracked curb we were sitting on, and the pavement quietly splintering under our shoes. I lurched to my feet, staring down at him. There was one last thing I had to know. "You wouldn't, because of this, do something terrible, would you?" He squinted up at me. "You wouldn't throw your life away?" "You mean commit suicide?" He looked insulted. "No." "I have to go." I turned and took off running,
though when he began shouting my name, asking where I was going, I threw back my head and turning, laughing crazily, I shouted, "I love you, Jim Mason! I always have!" I ran out of the parking lot into the 6-lane highway. Cars honked. A woman in a passing car rolled down the window and started to scream at me. "Get out of the way! Honey, what are you doing out here? Honey?" I could hear Jim calling me, but I stepped in front of a cement truck and closed my eyes. August 30. Wincroft. 6:12 p.m. Beatrice? Beatrice! Chapter 22. Martha, Kip, and Whitley were waiting for me in the library. There was no sign of Cannon.
"You made it, Bea,"
said Whitley, hugging me.
"What happened after we left?" asked Kipling.
I didn't answer. Instead, I slipped past them, heading straight to an upstairs bedroom. Minutes later, returning downstairs, my suspicions confirmed. I'd found what I'd been looking for. I explained where I'd gone. I told them about the connection I'd made between the man in the chicken costume handing out heart balloons, whom Vita had mentioned, the Honey Love fried chicken coupon left in Jim's case file, and the email in Edgar Mason's inbox. I told them about Estella Ornato. No one said a word for a long time. Whitley opened her laptop and Googled the name, then read aloud the only information that appeared about Estella's death, a 4-sentence mention in the South Shore Sentinel. "Officials have released the name of a 4-year-old child killed Wednesday night in a car accident in Watermill," she read. "S.O., I said to Martha. "I think it's Alonzo Ornato's son." Sure enough, a search of Ornato and Princeton turned up a Facebook page belonging to Sebastian Ornato, about to start his sophomore year. On his page, there was a photograph of him sitting in Firestone Library wearing a Princeton sweatshirt, grinning and making a goofy peace sign.
"Poor kid thinks he got into Princeton on his own steam," said Kipling.
"I can't believe it," said Whitley, solemn. "I knew Jim's family was capable of anything, but erasing the existence of an entire person, designing a new death that's more elegant and acceptable to all involved, and getting away with it?"
"It proves Jim's suicide, doesn't it?"
suggested Kipling, taking a deep breath.
"Jim probably felt so alone, lost. So he rode his bike out to Vulcan Quarry and jumped."
"I don't think so," I said. They turned to me in surprise. I told them what Jim had said in the parking lot.
"Well, if it wasn't suicide," said Whitley,
"then what happened?" I dug in my pocket and pulled out the bumblebee pin, placing it on the coffee table. Kip widened his eyes.
"What is that, child?"
"The gift Jim bought me freshman year."
"Oh, that's right," said Whitley.
"Didn't someone steal it from you?" asked Martha.
I nodded. "I just found it upstairs in Whitley's jewelry case." Whit stared at me, her face pale. "You stole it from me. I know you did. It was one of your notorious thefts, wasn't it?"
"Bea, I'm so sorry. You never think. Little do you know how your most haphazard gestures inflict such pain. It hurts to be your friend. It always has.
But I still love you." Ignoring Witt's astonished face, I went on to explain how I'd been stuck in the neck with the pin moments before the wake, which had sent me plunging back into the past with thoughts of Jim.
"I didn't do it, Bea," said Whitley. "I swear."
"I know. It was Cannon." Everyone gaped at me. "He knew you'd taken it, so he stole it out of your jewelry case the first night we changed the wake. He wanted to throw me off track, send the rest of you into a state of perpetual limbo. He doesn't want us to find out what happened to Jim. He doesn't want to ever leave the Neverworld."
"You think he had something to do with Jim's death?" asked Martha.
I don't know yet.
B does have a point, said Kipling with a dubious expression. Cannon knows if anything goes wrong, he's supposed to meet us here.